Hey everyone, it's Michelle,
Brayden,
and Mariana,
and this is Spooky Shit. So this week we're going to be talking about some creepypasta stories. We're just going to be going back and forth per use.
Warning, this episode may contain graphic details. Listener discretion is advised.
Yeah, but
first...
Don't do that.
Wow, okay. So we have a hater on the recording today.
I would like to introduce you guys to my
intro.
Annoying 16-year-old sister, Mariana.
Ew, don't say that.
Just That's kidding, it's Mariana.
I'm going to be struggling, yeah.
It's like the white way to say it is Mariana.
Mariana. Okay, I don't say that bad, at least.
Yeah, that's weird to say out of my mouth. It's Mariana.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Nah, I won't blast you. Oh, your middle name.
Is it bad?
No.
No. She likes it.
Yeah.
Oh, that, sounded like,
that sounded like a question mark.
I know, I was like, But yeah, our first guest spot ever. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, it was very last minute.
Yeah, literally, I sent an email and he was like, is it cool if my sister joins? And I was like, sure.
I don't know. And we just finished eating dinner, and I was like, hey, you want to, like, oh, I told her, you want to record for me? And she's like, do I got
to
read
stories?
You were
just trying to get replaced,
yeah.
First of all.
I was just trying to get out of it. I'm sorry. I'm tired.
I'm fucked up.
But then I was like, wait, actually, you want to be a guest? And she was like, yeah, I'm down.
So she's going to be reacting to our stories, not sharing stories.
She's too chicken to read,
next
I guess.
Time,
okay.
Next time, we're going to make you do
then
full
read a story. Exactly.
See? It's like, easy to make fun of us for messing up, but as soon as you read, you're like, oh, no.
Oh, my God, I'd cry.
She says she's going to roast me the whole time, because you know me, I can't read.
What?
Or speak.
Since when? That's weird. I've never noticed.
Uh-huh.
So how are both of you doing? I guess I have to ask both of you now.
I'm all right. Me.
16-year-olds are too cool for this podcast. Can't even tell us how you're doing.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it's whatever. Old woman.
I mean,
feel bullied.
I'm just tired because school is... No.
Oh, school.
No, thank you.
I always say it's so weird that people are still in high school, and I'm like, man, that sucks. Like, I didn't go to college or anything, so whenever I was done with high school, I was like, oh, done for life. Thank God. So it's brutal to me that people are still having experiences.
Yeah.
Is it just like Euphoria?
No. What? No.
All right, well, Brayden, how are you? Get some real answers out of you.
I'm tired too, for different reasons, not because it's cool.
There's some excitement going on. I'm also tired.
Actually, I mean, it's not really that exciting, but I did notice some hair on like my stomach, like a happy trail. I was like, what the fuck?
Doesn't everyone have a happy trail?
But
he's
like, it's darker
hair.
Well, because you have hair on your stomach.
You're gonna call me hairy. Don't even say it. Don't.
I have hair on my stomach.
But you
that's
are.
Like a little darker. But I'm imagining you're talking like darker, darker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That like because it's very noticeable. I was like, oh shit, that hair is like really dark.
Hey, I like that she called you out. That she's like, everyone has that.
I mean, duh, everyone has hair. Well,
women are actually hairy.
Except you have alopecia.
Alopecia, yeah.
Stupid. You're not wrong. That's sick. When's the beard coming in?
I don't know. How many chin hairs do I have right now?
Can we get an accurate
count? Three.
I have three.
Whoa.
So got
like five
three.
More and we're good.
Yep.
Cool, eight just spread throughout.
Maybe more.
Okay, we gonna
find
a
fourth? This lighting sucks.
You gotta get that harsh lighting to find a little beard.
Oh.
There's another one going in, so four.
Hell yeah.
Four.
Halfway to a full beard. Let's go.
Halfway. I can't think right now.
How's Costco been treating you? I'll just ask specific questions. I could tell you're good. Thrown off that she's there.
A little bit.
Yeah. I'm like your little interviewer now.
It's good. I mean, getting full hours. It was payday today.
Nice.
I don't work tomorrow, so that's fun. We're going to go up to LA.
Cool.
To this, like, a food market thing.
She doesn't know about this.
No,
she's doesn't. Making faces. We should record the video of this. This is hilarious. Your reactions are great.
She said, what the fuck? Oh my gosh, she's like this all the time, making faces and like little hand movements.
You're very, like...
and rolling her eyes at me, because, you know.
She's a cool teen. We wouldn't get it. We're too old.
Exactly.
Yeah, y'all are old.
Shut the fuck up.
I'm just kidding. Oh, you are.
Oh my gosh, I am actually almost 10 years older than you. I am old.
Are you? Oh yeah, huh?
I'm gonna be 26 this year. Yeah, I know.
She's literally 10 years old.
That's
damn.
Just kidding.
You're like, oh, so she really is old. Okay. Never mind.
No, we're just missing. But yeah, work is good. Today, I actually was proud of myself because I finished a lot of things really fast.
Nice.
As you should.
Not talking shit about you anymore. Hey, there we go.
As you should, bro.
But yeah, I mean, just obviously my sleep schedule is still a little fucked. But it's good.
You're still in weird hours, right?
Yeah.
Ew.
R.I.P. Brayden.
I know, right?
It's okay, though.
But yeah, I got my hair cut yesterday, actually, from some of my classmates.
Yeah, I could just see you actively checking yourself out in the webcam. You're thinking. No. I was like, oh, it looks like he's looking at me. And I was like, he's looking at the webcam. He's looking
at
himself.
I am looking at you, but you're frozen.
I'm frozen?
Yes.
Damn.
Like, you just look like...
Oh, I'm not frozen on my screen, so that's like... Well... Hopefully I look good. I'm sure I do.
Oh
there, don't yeah, you unfroze.
You're not frozen no more.
Hey, okay.
I was going to say something else, but I forgot.
You got your hair cut.
Uh-huh.
Relevant to that?
No.
Okay. Well, you quit barber school?
What? No.
I don't know. I'm just wondering. I'm trying to jog your memory.
She said, quit that shit.
Was that song from Grease, Beauty School Dropout? Could be you. Could be like that girl with the pink hair. Have you not seen that movie?
Yes. Grease?
Nope.
Grease? Oh my god, we're old.
You haven't seen Grease? Why'd you look at me like, no,
to
I haven't.
Be fair,
have.
Grease...
No, I haven't.
With John Travolta?
Never seen Grease.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. To be fair, it came out like 15 years before we were even born. I don't know why I've seen it so many times.
Same.
We're not that old, okay?
Yeah, I'm young, okay?
Yeah. Okay. Wow, that's the first time I've made a reference and hasn't been like, what? It's so like jarring. I feel weird.
She makes you feel old.
I know. What the fuck? I didn't realize how old I was until I was like, I'm almost 10 years older than you. And I was like, oh, that's weird.
I know shit makes me feel old because like she'd be using like new like slang or terminology and I'm like, what the fuck?
Ooh, resident teenager. What are the teens saying now?
Honestly, they're just fucking weird. Like, I don't even use half of them because they're just like, what the fuck are you saying?
What's your favorite slang right now? What are the cool kids saying?
I've actually been saying this all day. It's
ooh, okay. I hope it's as funny as it probably is.
Probably not. But it's like, I saw it on TikTok. It's like this sound, and it goes, I fucks with these crab cakes. I'm about to tear these bitches up. It's from the, you've seen that show. I forgot what it's called, though.
Oh, yeah. I definitely seen
okay,
it.
You know what? Why
that's the evil diabolical laugh.
we should tell them the story that you were telling us right now during dinner.
Oh, it wasn't even that funny. Honestly, I was just telling them because my friend had snapped me while I was waiting in the car with my mom for an appointment. And my friend snapped me and she goes, oh my God, I had just seen your brother's wife at Costco. And Brayden looks at Victor like, you have a wife? And I was like, I forgot.
I deadass, like, was so confused. And I looked at my brother and I was like, you have a wife?
You're so fucking stupid.
I was like, how can you forget? Literally?
I don't know. It just, like, slipped my mind for a second. Even my mom, too. Like,
everyone looked confused except for Alaris. Yeah. Alaris was just like, oh, it's me.
Yeah, Alaris,
and then
like,
my mom,
right,
and then
away.
Brayden was like,
I first literally... for a second, I felt confused because I forget that you're married, and I'm like, oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, but I started, like,
you have a
laughing so hard.
But, oh, my God.
Just because, like, I was like, your brother, really?
That's so funny. Oh my
I'm like,
God.
Oh, wait, I'm her brother, too.
It's me.
Oh, it was funny, though.
That's actually great. I like that. That was as funny as he made it seem. That was good.
But yeah, I can't really think of anything. We'll see. So maybe something will come up.
As it does.
Maybe.
How are you?
I was just going to like annoyingly say, how am I, you ask? But thank you for asking. You probably all remember from last year, me trying to make a stray cat love me. It's a frequent thing I do. We live near a school and there's like a colony of cats there, I'm pretty fucking sure. There's another cat that I'm trying to entice to be my baby. And I saw it 3 times so far and I fed it yesterday. It wasn't there today, but we're working on it. So things are looking up. Might be bringing Momo home soon sometime. He's named Momo.
You named him already?
After Avatar The Last Airbender, you know the little lemur thing, Momo?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's like black and white. And I'm like, it's like Momo.
That's cute.
Who doesn't name stray animals? Because I do.
Okay, it's kind of fucked up.
How many stray animals you know?
Quite a few.
Okay.
They like to hang around in my school, so.
See, they just love schools. Like, what's up with them at schools? It's weird. But, yeah, it's kind of fucked up because Momo's also the name of the stray cat I was trying to entice last year. So I'm just recycling names at this point until I can take one home.
So original.
Someday I will have a little Momo.
That's cute.
Yeah. And then... other than that, I've been streaming a lot, obviously. That's all I do now. I stream till like 3 in the morning. I wake up at noon. It's so weird. Feels gross.
Yeah.
But it's kind of fun. Just playing video games. Can't really complain. Oh,
yeah. I was literally going to say, yesterday I didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And the night before I did. So I went to bed at like 9. And then I didn't get up until, like, 11.
Your body was catching up.
Yeah. I was like...
That was brutal.
And then I basically stayed in bed until, like, 3. And then I was like, okay, I gotta get ready for school.
You were in bed for, like, 20 hours.
I really was.
Oh, my God. See, I'm not that crazy. The other week, I did wake up at 2 p.m., though. That sucked. But I went to sleep, like, 6:30. So, it had to happen.
Damn.
Yeah. I'm feeling very judged by her right now.
No, she's
too
actually
expressive.
Like,
she's judging.
I'm over
me.
Here because I can relate.
She's Ooh. Saying same in her head.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been going like, to sleep at like I don't even know. Sometimes I don't even sleep.
Okay, you need to sleep. You're like a baby. You're still growing. So you should sleep.
I should.
Yeah.
I mean,
we don't
have
need sleep
that.
Because we're old. We just sleep anyway.
What you mean?
It's like, I'm still young.
No, I need my sleep.
No, yeah, me too.
It's either I don't sleep or I just sleep.
There's no in between. There's no healthy amount of sleep.
Exactly.
Exactly. You sleep way too much or
not
enough.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like no matter how much I sleep, it's not enough. I like I'm on antidepressants. I talked to a psychiatrist the other day, just like check in, see how they're doing. And I was like, yeah, I kind of feel like I'm just tired at all times, no matter what. And he's like, I think your body needs a schedule because you sound like you're fucking yourself up right now. So like, sometimes I wake up at noon, other times like 10. And he's like, you need a schedule, dude. And yeah. I took that as him saying sleep until noon every day.
Yeah, hey, that's technically a schedule.
Yeah, and then whenever I move to Europe, as per the dream, I'll start week camp early then. First,
true.
I just need 1,000 people to sub to us on Twitch consistently every month. And then I can move. I see 2 subs potentially right here. You guys are like, avoid eye contact, look down. That's a nice wall. Yeah, that's all I've been up to. I haven't really been doing much. So we can jump into the stories now if you want.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I already know you're going to fuck up more because she's here, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a little nervous, but that's okay.
That's okay.
All right. This one's called Distorted Warning Signals, written by Ashley Rose Wellman. When I got the first one, I was literally seconds away from stepping onto the plane when a call from unknown blared from my cell phone. It was a ringtone I hadn't heard before, one I was pretty sure hadn't come with my phone.
You mean normally? Not normally?
How many senses in are we, 2?
Yeah, basically.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
Okay.
Welcome to our recording life. This is what I experience every week.
Yep.
Normally?
Normally. Please don't you want say me to like finish that. This? That was hella weird. Normally.
Normally, I wouldn't have stopped to answer it, but I was expecting a call about a job I had interviewed for the previous week. I took a deep breath in and accepted the call. Hello? To not get on that plane. A woman's voice garbled and strange as if her vocal cords had been shredded, and she was trying desperately to choke out speech. Despite the unnerving, fractured quality of her voice, her tone was insistent and eerily calm. Then the call ended. I froze. I had always had a slight phobia of air travel, and something about this call just, there was no way I could get on a 7-hour flight now. I turned around and headed toward the food court. I'd just get on another flight later in the afternoon, I figured. I watched from the airport Starbucks 3 hours later as every TV in the terminal lit up with the crash footage of the plane I should have been on. No survivors, not a single one. I tried to trace the call, so did the police, but there was nothing to trace. There was no evidence my phone had ever received a call around that time. They analyzed my phone records, incoming and outgoing communication to my phone. Nothing. I wasn't making it up. I couldn't have been. That wasn't the only call. Throughout the years, there were few and far between, but always right, and I always listen. Do not go on that blind date tonight. 5 months later, my would-be date was convicted of killing 4 women, all with my hair color and build. Found them in a shallow grave about 250 feet from the diner he offered to take me to.
The fuck?
Yeah, right? Do not drive to the concert tonight. 18-wheeler lost control and plowed into a line of cars. Every driver crushed, every driver killed. In the stretch of a freeway I would have been driving down. No matter if I got a new phone, if I moved across the country, the calls would still come. I could almost feel the presence of whatever it was, whatever it is, watching over me. I imagined being at the bottom of the freezing ocean, still strapped into my coach section plane seat, or being in the massive grave across from the diner, or watching an 18-wheeler skidding down towards my car. Knowing death was imminent and I'd get this tightness in my chest. I think about how thin that line was, how close I'd gotten. If I hadn't had a job interview I was waiting to hear back from, I'd have never listened to the first call, and that would have been it for me. It always felt like something was coming for me, but there was always this fractured, warped voice with these calls that never seemed to exist after I heard them. Self-destructing warning signals rotting away before my eyes, and I was alive. I had a bad feeling about this cruise. I had planned it as a girls' week out with some of my old friends from college and was looking forward to a week in the tropics in the dead of winter, but part of me could almost sense that the call was coming. Maybe I'd watched Titanic one too many times, but there was a little nagging fear from the start. I hoped it would be fine, but I knew if something was going to happen, I'd get the call. I'd know. Now, a week before I'm set to go on the cruise, after stepping into my apartment, after returning from the diner with my friend, I notice my cell has a message from unknown. They've never had to leave a message before, haven't checked in all night. Damn it. And I had really wanted to go to the cruise, too. Ah, well, not worth whatever horrific fate awaited me in the dark, cold ocean. I click play message and feel my stomach drop as I listen to the voice sounding horrifically distorted, as if it emanates from the throat slashed to ribbons, crackling with more urgency than ever before. I look around my apartment as the voice on the phone repeats the same phrase over and over again. Do not come home after dinner tonight. Do not come home after dinner tonight. Do not come home after dinner tonight.
Ew, I just got chills. Bro, if you're getting warning phone calls and you're about to fucking die, who's like, I'm gonna leave my phone at home while I go out to eat? Like, I keep that shit on me. Yep. Ew. Gross, gross, gross.
That is so gross.
That's like some, what is it, Final Destination shit?
Oh my god, don't even start it on that.
But imagine if that's real. How unlucky are you to be like this many incidents where you would have fucking died? I'm like, damn. I would just never leave my apartment.
Damn. That's no way to live, though.
True. I was literally agoraphobic in high school. It sucked. It was not fun. All right. So my story is called I Dove to Death's Uncharted. They Should Have Stayed That Way. And it's written by Spooky Dude 43. Probably their birth name. The first thought that crossed my mind as I hit the water was how warm it was. We left for Galapagos in mid-December, arriving on site towards the end of the month. I thought it'd be cold. December has always been a time of cold nights and long snowy days for me. So when I broke the water and was greeted not by an icy wall of goosebumps-inducing darkness, but a comfortable lukewarm ocean, I was pleasantly surprised. An unpleasant surprise followed shortly after, as the radio in my ear blared to life, the voice of Anne, already grainy and hard to make out despite being only 15 feet above me, highlighting the budgetary shortcomings of our expedition. Ground control to Kappa 1. Actually, I wouldn't be ground control, would I, since I'm, you know, not on the ground. What would you call the boat version of ground control? Anne asked, our new radio quickly becoming a toy in her eyes. Now hang on, why am I Kappa 1? I called back into the radio, ignoring her question that I admittedly did not know the answer to. Because Kappas live in the water, duh. She called back rather matter-of-factly before giggling at her own cleverness. A splash is heard some distance to my left before the radio picks up again, a man's voice this time. This is Kappa 2, I'm in the water. Brett called out, our youngest member, though he had been with the company longer than I had. You don't need to say that, I just watched you jump in, Anne called, chastising. I know, just couldn't let you two have all the fun with the new radio, Brett rebutted, while I was slowly starting to regret our buying the thing. All right, enough playing around, we're wasting sunlight, came the voice of our senior, Robert. He was a no-nonsense as ever, although this was somewhat endearing of him. He always kept a cool head on his shoulders and kept us focused. Jason, move into the bell. Brett, retrieve the sea scooter and join him. We want this done before sunset, Robert directed through the radio. I wasted no time swimming over to the large device dangling from our boat by a thick metal cable. It was almost shaped like a bell, as our nickname suggested. A large bottom-heavy structure that narrowed at the top and widened at the bottom. It was around 7 feet tall and half that in diameter. Four small round windows positioned on its north, south, west, and eastmost sides, and one large hatch on the bottom. As I moved to climb inside this hatch, Brett joined me at my side, using a sea scooter to catch up, its light illuminating the diving chamber in the dark ocean water. I was a little jealous Robert had chosen him to pioneer the sea scooter for our company and not me. It was a small device, no bigger than the motor of a weed whacker. At its rear were two handles with a small lever to pull on the right and a button for the light on the left. Attached to these handles was the motor, a loud thing, strong enough to turn the blades at the front of the device to propel its occupant forward faster than they could swim. Just beyond the propellers, right in the center, was a large light. I could see Brett's smile showing through the thin glass of his mask, and he as he delighted in his new toy, and we both climbed into the chamber, sealing it shut behind us while we began to build pressure. I took a seat opposite Brett, and we could feel the chamber moving, sinking through the water a few feet at a time. It was an odd sensation. The water inside didn't jostle or move, but we could feel the world pulling upon us as we sank down deeper and deeper. Robert's voice came over the radio again, growing fuzzier, but not so much that we couldn't make it out. Remember to watch your depth gauges and don't go too deep. Those suits the NOAA lent us will get you to the vents and maybe a little deeper. Let's not find out how much deeper. Just chart the entrance of the trench, leave your markers, and get back to the bell. Roger, roger, Brett called into the radio, and I heard Robert let out a sigh. Now we started to wait. As the chamber sank into the depths, it built pressure to acclimatize us to the pressure of the ocean at our desired depth. That way we could get out, do our work, and decompress in the bell instead of doing decompression stops in open water, which is going to be nice, as decompression from this depth would take close to 14 hours. Our air tanks hooked up to the tubes in the bell, running the cord of the bell all the way up to the surface, so we shouldn't have to worry about running out of air. I stared at the depth gauge on my left wrist, watching it tick up as it worked even from within the bell, ticking past 1,000 meters already. It was nice to have such a fancy bit of hardware in the form of these suits. Our bell and scooter were as outdated as they get, and our boat was on our last sea legs. This job could have been the start of something new with any luck. It would lead to more business with the NOAA, and our little diving shop might make it yet. Suddenly, a question shot to the front of my mind, a question I aired over the radio to our captain. Why us? My question was met with silence at first, and a funny look from Brett before he spoke up. Well, because Anne doesn't dive, she mans the ship, and Robert's too old to make it down here anymore. Careful too, you know he's sensitive, Anne teased back at us, and Robert let off what could have been a chuckle or maybe a cough. It was hard to tell. That's not what I mean. I mean, why did the NOAA hire us for this? Don't they have divers and dives with better gear? Divers they trust with these fancy suits a hell of a lot more than a basically unheard of diving team? There's a long silence after this. I thought maybe he knew the answer but didn't want to say. It seemed everyone took a few moments to ponder this question, or maybe the others were waiting for our captain's response like I was. Regardless, our thoughts were interrupted by the bell jerking to a stop, causing us to swing and sway in the water before we steadied again. Brett was up first, hands cupped around his eyes at the window, searching for whatever it was we came here for. No, that can't be right, he mumbled to himself before beginning to undo the hatch. I moved to the window to see whatever it was he saw, but I saw nothing. An endless expanse of dark water lay before me, at least I think it did. It was dark and I couldn't make out that much. What is it? I don't see anything. My eyes didn't leave the window as I asked, waiting to see some colossal beast swim by or some ravaged sea life. My mind started to swim as I waited for his answer. He didn't reply. Not until he had left the bell, ducking into the water and drifting just below the hatch, floating motionless in place as he looked out at the surrounding ocean, the lights of the bell finally clicking on, revealing more of the nothingness around us. That's the problem. Check your depth gauge. And I did as he instructed, reeling our depth. We were 2,600 meters below the surface, the deepest anyone had ever gone without a submersible. The vents, he started. We should have hit the floor 50 meters ago. This can't be the right place. The hydrothermal vents are gone. He sounded angry and a little confused. Robert called to him over the radio, trying to calm him down. Brett, it's a newly formed trench. The vents are still there, just moved. If you get back into the bell, we can adjust position until we find the edge. It should be more than a few dozen meters away. Brett ignored him, swimming away from the bell now. Brett, I called out. Stay near the bell. If you get lost down here, we'll net. I was cut off before I could finish. Brett starting to shout into the radio, turning his sea scooter on and propelling forward, with me following along against my better judgment, trying to keep a mental note of where the bell was. No, this is impossible. The edge isn't a dozen meters away, and there is no edge. This trench is massive. A trench this large forming and so close to land, there should have been tsunamis and earthquakes. This kind of damage doesn't just happen without anyone noticing. We were at 2,700 meters and getting deeper by the second as he searched for the ocean floor. Comms were quiet for a moment before Anne spoke up. Brett, it's okay. I need you to go back to the bell. We'll figure this out. I'm sure the NOAA have an explanation for what happened here. She spoke soothingly and Brett slowed, coming to a stop at 2,750 meters, with me just a few behind him. He took in a breath, looking around the expanse of the ocean before us. He'd always been more of an environmentalist than I. I can't imagine how seeing such an important part of sea life cease to exist must have made him feel. I put a hand on his shoulder, trying to guide him back. Come on, let's get back to the bell. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we can get answers. He looked back at me, his face betraying how upset he was as he tried to sound calm. He didn't look angry anymore, just sad. Maybe that was worse. Yeah, okay, he spoke softly with a sigh, starting to position the skewer to take us back, when suddenly we saw something. What is that? Brett asked, his tone curious as a small dark object slowly floated up towards us from the chasm below. It looks like a fish, he offered, and he seemed to be right. A small, skinny fish is floating up between us, at our legs now. Robert's concerned voice came over the radio, each word dripping worry. What do you see? Are you two all right? Anne was also talking now, her voice quiet and meek. Is there something down there with you? The fish kept on rising. It wasn't swimming. Its side was facing up, tail dragging behind it, and one empty eye socket pointed to the sky, and it was covered in what looked like red seaweed, wriggling and waving in the light ocean current. It looks like a dead fish, just floating here, Brett finally answered, though his calm demeanor was broken by what I said and what we saw next. There are more, look. I pointed down, seeing dark shapes rising towards the surface from below, dozens of them. Fish, turtles, stingrays, all looking half-decayed, none moving. Each one was covered in the red seaweed. Some had much bigger patches of it on them than others, and as the fish rose closer to us, we could see at last that it was not seaweed, but would look to be worms of some sort, sticking out of dozens of small holes in their skin. They were skinny and long, each one waving around in the water as though feeling for something else to latch onto. At what appeared to be their head was a single disc-like growth, flat and skinny but relatively wide, maybe an inch and a half in diameter. Brett slowly reached towards the thing, his hand tentative but driven on by his growing curiosity. As his hand approached the fish, I thought to stop him, to reach out and swat his hand away, or to tell him no. Instead, movements made clumsy by the water all around us, I reached out and touched the fish. Instantly, the worms had driven the flat growth of their head against my suit's glove, and I felt an awful pinching sensation as they wriggled and shook violently. I let out a yelp, shaking my hand as I tried to dislodge the creature, but they held fast, the pain in my hand increasing as my panic rose. I thought to grab them and pry them off, but I feared more were inside the corpse of the fish, waiting to latch onto me and exasperate the situation. Finally, Brick grabbed my wrist and, with his knife, cut at the wretched things. They held for a few cuts before withdrawing into the fish, releasing my glove. None of them had been severed by his knife. I looked at my shaking hand, sucking in deep breaths as I tried to calm myself, the voices of Robert and Anne cutting each other off as they tried to ask what was wrong, what was happening to me, and demanding we return to the bell. My glove had several large indents in the material. The gloves were a strong fabric, but here it seemed they were almost chewed through, long cut-like scrapes and circles moving towards the central point where each of the worms had held on to me. Brett's voice came over the radio. The other two resigned to not getting an answer and clearing the comms. It's all right, they didn't get in. Captain, there's some sort of worms living in the Dead Sea life down here. Definitely unfriendly. We're going back to the bell. Get ready to take us up. I'll get on the radio at the Coast Guard. And man the crane. Robert's voice was stern and commanding. It was comforting to have someone sound collected and control the situation. Looking around us, things were not in control. Dead Sea life was all around us, slowly moving past as they floated for the surface. It was like a swarm of jellyfish. We didn't want to get close and touch any of them, but if we didn't move more, they would float up and surely touch us. Looking around, I didn't even know where the bell was. We'd left it so long ago, and orienting yourself in the open ocean was like swimming around in a pitch black room and then trying to find a bed. Where's the bell? I asked, more to myself than anyone else. Anne and Robert couldn't help us reach it. The best they could do is keep it in place and hope we see the lights again. We have to go back the way we came. Just go nice and slow, and I'll use the scooter to push them out of the way. Brett presented his plan. It sounded like a good one. He moved in front of me, using the lights of his sea scooter to shine us a clear path, and turned the engine on. This was a mistake. Once the engine turned on, the sea life stopped moving. Each one close enough for us to see stopped dead in their tracks, no longer drifting towards the surface. What the fuck? Brett choked out before slowly but surely each decaying fish began to move towards us. Where before we had a path, we are now slowly being closed in on by massive dead animals, worms reaching with all their might towards us. Brett's voice was scared now, lacking the determination his plan had offered it before. Captain, they're coming towards us. We can't slip past. Not this many, he cried out, pointing the light of the scooter around like it was some sort of gun to hold them back. But they crawled on, moving closer and closer. Stay calm, son. There has to be a way out. Just stay calm and look around. There are Coast Guard ships on the way now, Robert assured us over the radio. I knew it wouldn't matter. Even if the Coast Guard were here right now, they could never make it to these depths, not without our suits. Maybe at the submersible, but then what would they do? Ram the things out of the way? I kept this to myself, not wanting to upset Brett any more than he already was. I need him to come up with a plan like before, some way to get us out of here. It struck me then, if I were wrong, well, we wouldn't need the sea scooter anyways. I reached out and grabbed it, pulling it away from him. Hey, don't you leave me here, he cried out, fear in his eyes as he held tight, but it didn't matter. I was bigger than him, and after a brief tussle, I had the scooter. I pointed it away from us, turned the engine up to medium, and let go, watching it drift away from us. What are you doing? Brett demanded, grabbing my shoulders and spinning me around to face him. We needed that. You've killed us both. Around this time, the first fish drifted past us, towards the direction of the sea scooter. He let go and turned around. We had to dodge them a bit, but they were moving past us, leaving us alone. I think they were drawn to the sound. When you turned it on, they came towards it, so I turned it up and sent it away, I explained, trying to keep him calm. Well, you could have just said that, asshole. He was still angry, but too relieved to hold on to it. He turned, and we both started to swim, making our way to where he claimed the bell was, careful to avoid the sea life that hadn't been close enough to notice the sea scooter. With each passing meter, I grew more concerned. If this was the wrong direction, we were only getting ourselves more lost, and these things, these dead things, were still with us. A little more spread out, but they were here, and I was worried more would come up, and it'd be too dense a group to swim through. As my fears began to bubble to the surface and form words in my throat, my thoughts were interrupted again when Brett shouted over the radio, "There it is, the light! I can see the bell!" I swam a bit faster, straining to see what he saw, and sure enough, just ahead, there was a light. He swam towards it, fast, waving his arms and breathing heavily as he raced for it, ignoring the fish floating around him and rushing for the bell. As we got close, I began to notice something. There was something big just below it. "Brett, stop! There's something there!" I tried to call, but over his frantic breathing, the radio was too garbled for him to understand. Maybe he thought I was celebrating as well. I should have tried harder, yelled louder. Something. But I didn't. Didn't think he would be able to hear me. And as he neared the bell, the thing below rose into the light, coming into view and freezing him in his tracks. It was a whale, a huge humpback whale, but this one wasn't dead and it wasn't drifting, though just barely. It had huge holes all along its left side and tightly packed clusters. The skin they clustered on was swollen and infected, the holes leaking a dark fluid into the water. Its body was lumpy, long tubular growths protruding all down its back into its tail, and these bumps wriggled and moved, twitching and causing the body to move along with them. One of its eye sockets was empty, and the other eye, while still there, had a large hole in it, with a huge worm sticking out of the front. It slowly approached Brett, its one big eye locked onto him as the worm reached for him, both of us frozen in shock. As it neared him, the whale let out an awful sound, a groan of pain and anguish as its mouth was pushed open by massive worms inside. They reached out, latched onto Brett, causing him to jolt to action again. Flailing and screaming, jabbing at them with his knife to no avail as one latched onto his face, slowly pulling him into the mouth. He screamed into it, screamed and cried and fought for all he was worth, but he wasn't getting away and I only watched as it took him. Once he was gone and the mouth was closed, his screams did not stop. They kept coming over the radio, drowning out anything anyone else might have tried to say. The whale then slowly sank, leaving the light of the bell and vanishing into the darkness. I wasted no time swimming for all I was worth, looking at the bell and hoping that maybe if I didn't look, I wouldn't have to see it rising to swallow me too. But it didn't swallow me. It didn't return as I swam into the bell, didn't attack me as I sealed the hatch and pressed the button to return me to the surface, and it didn't rip the bell from the ship and sink me to the ocean floor as I waited for the bell to slowly rise out of the depths. But he did scream. He screamed the whole way, and as he did, his screams slowly became groans of pain, muffled by whatever it was that had him. And just when I thought I couldn't take the screams anymore, he spoke. He begged. He begged not for his life, not for rescue, not for me to come back and save him. He begged for me to kill him. Pleaded with me in a voice so weak and with breath so raspy, breathing wheezily, unnaturally, he pleaded with me and with God and with the devil to kill him and free him from the pain he suffered. And when our radios finally disconnected, I wept and I hoped that he got his wish. I don't dive anymore. I man the crane, but I'll never get in that water again. I'd leave, say goodbye to this life and to the war forever, but I can't do that to Robert and Anne. I can't leave them in this business behind after what we went through together. So I man the boat and I lower the bell, but I don't think the ocean is safe anymore. Because sometimes on long jobs during late nights in the water, our radio will pick up something. It's always staticky and hard to make out, but I know what it is. He's still begging us to kill him.
Jeez.
The end.
Oh my god. Woo. It's so scary. Another reason to hate the ocean.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm saying.
Jesus.
Big facts.
The ocean is just scary.
Yeah, fuck that shit.
Never invite me on a cruise. Never. Ever, ever, ever.
I was just going to say we should all go on a haunted diving trip.
No. You're so funny.
I'm actually not down for
what?
I'll go somewhere haunted, but not the ocean.
Ooh, okay.
So you're going to read this one?
Okay, I guess I'll read. Look away. I'm just kidding.
Everyone close their eyes.
Yeah, close your guys' eyes. Go to sleep.
Oh yeah, our listeners are called the little shits.
The little shits? Oh my god, I love that. Yeah, so right? Iconic.
That's why I said. Listen up, little shits.
What's up, little shits? Let's get spooky.
Okay, so this story is called The Nightwalker by Stephen Allen. It was a foggy autumn night when I first encountered him. As I was driving home from my late shift at the hospital, I came across a rather unusual person. As I turned into the street, into my neighborhood, I saw a tall man dressed in a dark hoodie walking on the right side of the street. Given the area I lived in, he seemed out of place. As I passed him, I attempted to get a better look at his face, but with his hood being up and it being dark outside, I was unable to. I tried hard not to be too judgmental. After all, for all I knew, he was just one of my neighbors whom hadn't met yet.
You guys. You guys. I read you this story a few weeks ago, you motherfucker.
I didn't pay attention.
That's so rude. You were reading and I was like, this sounds so familiar. I'm sorry.
Brayden just outed himself.
Yeah, that's fucked up. It's the one that they're like, don't judge a book by its cover at the end, right?
I have no idea. I didn't read it.
I wasn't paying attention to her.
Oh.
Okay. I think I read this. Scroll to the bottom and see if it says don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, it is.
You're really going to read the same story.
God damn it.
I'm sorry.
I mean, it totally like
flew over your head.
That's hilarious. Do you have another one to read?
Or here, I have this one.
Alright, so round two. Let's hope this isn't another one we've read.
No, I'm pretty sure you haven't read this one.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so this one's called Freak Next Door by Adrian Johnson. Ooh, okay. I lived next to this one kid who always had bandages wrapped around their whole head, even covering their face. I remembered his name was Wilbur, a 12-year-old boy who never left his house. He sometimes looked out of his bedroom window on the top floor at all of the kids who played outside, while Wilbur sat and watched. I remembered his windows had metal bars on them, so there was no way he could climb out of his bedroom windows. We sometimes communicated to each other by writing to each other on a piece of paper, since Wilbur can't hear me because the windows was locked. Wilbur only does it when his parents aren't around, since they're weird.
They're abusive, it sounds like, if they fucking lock him in a room.
That is... What if he's not alive? Anyways.
Oh, yeah, you haven't even read this, huh? You're just going in blindly.
Yep.
I read it.
Okay.
See, you know how this ends. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Don't look at him.
His mother and father were one of those parents that were insanely crazy about science and chemistry, according to Wilbur. They would stay in their basement and work all day and night, except at the times where they had to give Wilbur food daily. Now, they're not treating him like an animal. His parents are just very busy. They told Wilbur that he shouldn't go outside to make contact with anyone until his face got better. He told me that he accidentally slipped on one of his parents' chemicals, fell face first, ruining his appearance. His parents feared that he would be made fun of by the other kids in the neighborhood. I remember one time, a couple of older kids were throwing rocks and pebbles at his window, laughing and pointing at Wilbur as he looked down at them. He told me that they would do it a few times, but he's used to it. But to me, he's a great guy, and still is to this day. I have never been inside his house, but he had shown me some cool stuff he had collected, like comic books. He had loads of them, from Marvel to DC to other non-superhero comics. He was a huge superhero fan. He even said that he felt like a superhero, a normal human being who became affected by dangerous chemicals and then became a powerful superhero. He once wrote on a piece of paper and had put it up onto his window as he pretended to be a superhero. I had a collection of action figures and video games that amazed Wilbur. He told me that he had never played a single video game in his life, which is quite sad. He also told me that his babysitter took them away from him before he could play them and burnt them in front of him. That's fucked up.
Fucking rude babysitter.
Holy shit. I know. What the hell? Wilbur had a mean babysitter named Miss Frisgard?
Fitzgerald.
Oh.
Frisgard.
Fitzgerald.
You're now officially a host of spooky shit. That was good.
It's because Brayden's rubbing off against me right now.
Okay.
Exactly. It's contagious, actually.
It is. Oh my god. I'll be fine speaking like fluent English and then.
Nah.
Brayden? Mm-mm. Anyways, Wilbur had a mean babysitter named Miss Fitzgerald, a tall, mean lady who never liked kids at all. This started before his face became messed up, he told me. She was basically every kid's nightmare, all of the things I've heard she has done. Miss Fitzgerald had babysat many kids before, and trust me, it was not pretty. Wilbur told me that the last kid she babysitted was a 4-year-old girl. She made her live through 7 hours of hell. Wilbur said that Miss Fitzgerald starved her and surrounded her bed with a few bear traps. And the worst thing that happened, the parents didn't even know about her deed. She would lie to them just to get paid.
What the fuck?
Bear traps? And yeah. She was 4. Oh my. Hell no. All those things I've heard, she is foul. Cruel woman with no soul at all. And now she had to babysit this poor guy. Wilbur was old enough to make his own decisions, except for some. But his parents apparently hired an evil witch. The parents had to go to Texas to a scientist convention. So Wilbur was left alone with her. One time, I was writing about her to show him. But then I saw Miss Fitzgerald forcibly pulling him away from the window. And that was the rest of my day without talking to him. The next day, when I looked through my window to see Wilbur, I saw someone lying down on his bed. Looking at the person's wrapped head, I banged my fist on the window, trying to get Wilbur's attention. He slowly sat up on his bed, wiping away tears from his eyes. He seemed to be crying, which gave me a thought. I had a worried look on my face as I saw bruises all over his arms and legs, and a faded dark dome purple. He went to write something down on a piece of paper. Then, as Wilbur finished writing, he went up to the window and pressed the note against the glass. What he wrote terrified me. The whole situation was still burnt in the back of my mind. Something I knew I would never forget. He wrote, "Help me." What made it worse was that the writing was all scribbled into the paper, was almost illegible. Wilbur kept banging on the window with his other hand. Then suddenly, I saw someone run into his bedroom next to him. It was her. You know who. She had something in both of her big chubby hands. In one hand was a lemon. In the other was a pair of scissors.
No.
What Miss Fitzgerald did terrified me even more. Miss Fitzgerald ran up to Wilbur, grabbing his head, holding it still. I saw him screaming in pain and fear, so I knew I had to do something. At the same time, I couldn't stop watching. She used her scissors to cut open the bandages, unwrapped them off his head, and threw them aside. And what I saw almost made me vomit. Something that sickened me. I was in utterly shock, looking at Wilbur's real, deformed face. His whole head was completely covered by bandages, and what was underneath, I knew the purpose of. I saw his face almost melted off, showing a dark red layer underneath. I could only imagine his face looking like a melted cheese on a cheeseburger. Wilbur's whole face, even one of his eyeballs, were burnt a little. The chemicals had messed him up really badly. Miss Fitzgerald sliced the lemon in half with the scissors, pinning Wilbur on his bed. Then she threw the scissors to the side next to the bandages and held his head still with one hand. With the other hand, she squeezed the sliced lemon onto Wilbur's head, into his eyes, onto the red layer of his face. The painful expression on his face, his loud, muffled screams, his face stinging from the acid of the lemon juice. What the fuck?
What the fuck?
Okay. She used the other lemon to squeeze onto his face again, torturing Wilbur with extreme pain. I decided to bang my fist on my window, which was a bad idea. Miss Fitzgerald looked over to the bedroom window right at me. I jumped back. She noticed me. She ran out of the bedroom, shoving Wilbur down as he screams in pain and agony. I knew what she was going to do, so I ran out of my bedroom and ran downstairs. The good thing about the situation was that my parents didn't know about Wilbur and the fact that they were at work for a little. I locked the front door, hoping Miss Fitzgerald wouldn't burst in into my house. I looked around for the house phone, but as I was, a loud bang rang my ears. I looked behind myself at the door, noticing her red, sweaty face and her curly blonde hair. By the looks in her eyes, she knew there was going to be some trouble. She kept banging on the door, nearly screaming her head off. As I looked around for the phone, I finally spotted it, next to the couch, on the coffee table. I ran towards it, dialing 911, as the sound of Miss Fitzgerald's threatening screams were heard from outside. Waiting for a few rings, I finally heard the operator's voice, the usual greetings from a 911 operator. I started explaining the whole situation from beginning to end as quickly and clear as possible. They told me to wait patiently as the police will arrive at my house soon. It took a few minutes for the police to arrive at my house. Not only did they arrive, but my parents arrived early from work as well. Apparently, they got a call from the police explaining my situation and decided to come home. My parents were extremely worried and frightened. They asked me more questions about it than the police did. I had explained everything from being friends with Wilbur to how his parents left him with an abusive babysitter to what she tried to do. About an hour later, a police officer came to me. He had said something he wanted to tell me about the horrible atrocities that took place next door. The truth about the babysitter, the parents, and Wilbur was truly shocking. Based on the evidence they found, Wilbur's parents weren't actually his parents at all. They adopted Wilbur from an orphanage out of town, only to perform an experiment on him. It was the reason why they moved to Texas to hide. The babysitter, Miss Fitzgerald, was part of the experiment too. In fact, Wilbur wasn't the first kid they adopted by the scientists. What the fuck? They had done illegal experiments on those orphans, and it was to find out how much pain a child can take before death, based on the cause of death and the age of the child. 38 children between the ages of 2 and 13 were reported missing. And Wilbur was one of them. There were security cameras on the outside and inside of the house. Right now, they arrested Miss Fitzgerald for child cruelty and the deaths of many children. And they're on the case to find two scientists. All of that, and I was friends with someone who would have been killed if I didn't call the police. Apparently, Wilbur was also tried to lie about almost everything he told me. He was trying to protect himself. He was sent to a newly trusted family, a married couple who lived out of town. Since then, I never saw him again. Until now. 20 years later, I went into the bar to get myself a few drinks by myself, when a man approached me. "Remember me?" he said, that familiar man smiling at me. I smiled back, realizing how long it's been since I last seen Wilbur. In fact, he looks like a nice, healthy man now, without bandages. He was a brown-haired man with sky blue eyes. He almost looked like a complete stranger. After that, we talked and drank a few glasses, finally speaking to each other in person. Wilbur and I knew that nobody would try to keep us apart. The scientist and the babysitter are probably locked away right now. After all, I still couldn't stop thinking of the fact that this man would have been killed if I didn't help save his life. The end.
Goddamn.
What the fuck? Jesus!
Like, it's kind of a weird thing, but my main question is, how did his face heal from chemical burns?
That is a great question.
They're like, he looked normal, and I'm like, he wouldn't. Or maybe they meant him. Healthy, yeah, besides the chemical burns. Yeah. Interesting. Huh. That's creepy, though. Ew, what the fuck?
You so got me thinking now.
They're basically just serial killers.
Basically.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I was like, whoa. Maybe his new family paid for it.
Paid for the burns to be removed? I don't think that's burns.
Or, I mean, like, for plastic or cosmetic surgery.
But, I mean, there'd still be, like, some type of deformity. You know?
I do like how, like, deeply we're all thinking about this fake story. We're like, make it make sense. Yeah. This little boy.
Maybe we're just overthinking it.
I agree. Sorry, I started that. So, next up, I'm going to be reading The Conjurer by E.J. Robinson. Twice in my life, I've wished for a magic wand. The first was 8 years into my marriage, when our heart-wrenchingly tender obstetrician told us there was nothing left to try. I never shared my husband's fascination with magic and conjuring tricks, but at that moment, hearing that news, I wished for a wand to magic up our longed-for baby. Conjure the missing piece of us. But there were no wands, and there was no magic. There was nothing we could do. Everyone told us this. So, when I fell pregnant out of the blue the following year, I marveled over how such a miracle had occurred. Fate? Divine intervention? Plans aligning? Well, David knew exactly where his faith lay. I'm telling you, Mama Bear, he said, touching his fingertips to my belly. This kid's magical. Fate, God, magic, I didn't care what he called it. I exulted in every terrifying moment of my glorious pregnancy. We had a healthy boy and named him Danny. As soon as he could hold a wand, our son wanted to be a magician. David bought him a magic set when he was 3, and we played the captive audience to his one mini-man shows. As the years passed, even David couldn't work out how our boy pulled off some of the tricks he showed us. I joked it was the day Danny wanted to saw one of us in half that we'd need to worry. Everything about those first 5 years of Danny's life, our life as a family, was magical. If something had slithered onto my shoulder to whisper that my husband had only 7 months to live, I would have laughed. So help me God, I would have laughed. But David collapsed one ordinary blue Sunday morning, and the future was shattered with a single word from the mouth of a stranger. Terminal was something he went through at an airport. It couldn't have anything to do with the body of my husband. Danny was not yet 6. How do we tell him? I asked David as we stood brushing our teeth the first night we knew forever was fragmenting. How do we tell him you're going to leave us and it's forever? We stared into one another's eyes in the mirrors, as though the ghost in the glass might tell us what to do. In the end, David spoke to Danny on his own. Us boys are going for a walk, Mama Bear, he said, taking Danny by one hand. Guard the castle for us. I watched them walk out to the garden, the difference between their heights seizing my throat. That was the second time I wished for a wand, to magic away the present horror and the future pain. But no spell caused the lumps that rose beneath David's skin. No enchantment lay waste to the body I cherished. I couldn't magic my husband better. I could only watch as the essence of him retreated and retreated the windows of his eyes to a place where I couldn't follow. After David's death, unpredictable moments pulled me to my knees. A man passing who smelled like him, a voice speaking in similar cadences. Behind such nothing moments, my husband's absence reared up to sucker punch me in the gut. If I hadn't had Danny, I wouldn't have made it. My son became the bridge, connecting me from one side of life to another over the gaping gulf of David's death. Danny carried me. Magic carried Danny. His dedication to practicing magic astounded me. At our library visits, he chose only books about magic and conjuring. He spent hours watching TV shows of his favorite magician, who sported the pedestrian name of Mike, and I spent hours watching my son perfect new tricks. A few months after David's funeral, I passed by Danny's room with a load of washing and spotted him sitting, wand in hand, whispering to the photograph of David by his bed. "What are you doing, bub?" I asked. Danny turned to me. "I'm telling Dad about the trick I'm working on. It's a present for you," he said, pulling the photo to his chest in a simulation of an embrace. I dabbed the corner of one eye with my shoulder and nudged to the door to walk over to my son and kiss his head. "Daddy would want you to keep doing the things you love, darling." Whilst I worried about all the time Danny spent alone, I reasoned that children, like adults, needed time to deal with loss in their own ways, so I left him to it. I believed I was doing the right thing, but as the weeks ground by and Danny's chats with his father's photograph showed no signs of waning, I felt some facts needed checking. "Danny, you do know that Daddy died and went to heaven, don't you?" "Yes, Mama." "And you know that heaven is such a nice place that no one who goes there wants to come back?" "Heaven can't be that nice for Daddy. We're not there." "We'll go there one day and see him again. We just have to wait a while." "I know." "Mama?" "Yes, Danny?" "While we're waiting, you should get a boyfriend."
Oh, okay. Wow, okay.
I know. 1 year passed, then 2, then 3. Danny settled into primary school and I went back to work, and a different kind of future stretched before us. A different kind of future required a different kind of man. I liked Joe for the things that made him unlike David. He believed in eating meals around a table with the TV off and in giving logical answers to fanciful questions. Only when I'd been seeing Joe for 4 months did I introduce him to Danny, as nervous as if arriving for a blind date. But my son had been waiting for me to bring another man into our lives, and he welcomed Joe into the house like all his Christmases had come at once. Joe knew nothing about magic or conjuring, and so Danny had a fresh and willing audience to show off his repertoire to. Sitting on the sofa, Joe and I, watching Danny swirl his wand and swing his cape, it was almost the same. Almost. One evening when we were alone in my bedroom after Danny was asleep, Joe stood by the bedside, rubbing the back of his neck. "Stop me if I cross the line here," he said. "Okay," I rearranged the duvet around me. "I'm not sure about some of those books Danny reads." "What about the book Danny reads?" "Don't you think," Joe sat on the edge of the bed and touched my hand, "some of them might take the whole magic thing a bit too far? One looked a tad occult to me." I slid my hand away. "You think Harry Potter is a cult? Kids having lessons to harness dark arts. What's not a cult about that? My 8-year-old son is not harnessing the dark arts. I'm just saying, you don't get to say you're not his..." I stopped myself, but when Joe climbed into bed, he turned his back to me. I wouldn't apologize. I couldn't. I liked Joe. In time, I might love him, but he would never be Danny's father. He knew it. I knew it. Danny knew it. 2 weeks before the 3rd anniversary of David's death, Danny came home from school, effervescent, and presented me with a letter. Mike the Conjurer was performing a show in a little theater in London, and Danny, along with 39 other children, were the competition winners invited to attend. "I didn't know you entered a competition, darling," I said. "We all had to do a magic trick in front of some teachers at school. That's what I was practicing all the times you were telling me to not be by myself so much," Danny said, grinning from ear to ear. "Gosh, well done, sweetie. So can we go to the show, can we?" "Of course we can go. It's your prize, my love." It fell, I noticed with a tug, on the date of David's anniversary. Danny had passed no comment on this, and I wondered if this is the beginning of David vanishing amongst other figments our son would soon associate with childhood. If, like Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy, David was destined to be shelved amongst childish things. "I get 3 tickets," Danny's cheerful babble permeated my sorrow. "Can Joe come too?" I brushed my aching eyes and smiled at my son. "Let's ask him," I said. I phoned Joe and told him to save the date. I heard his smile through the speaker. When the day arrived, Danny sat strapped into the backseat of the car, clutching his wand, sunny with pride that adults were having a night out because of him. He'd insisted on carrying a picture of David in his pocket, and gratitude filled me, seeing the significance of the day wasn't passing him by just yet. "Daddy loved magic. He'd like to be coming," he chattered as we drove to pick up Joe. "Yes, I'm glad we're doing something today that Daddy loved so much." "I'm not sure Joe will like it," I laughed. "Well, Joe doesn't like magic the way we do, does he? Maybe this is the show that'll change his mind, Danny boy." I turned onto Joe's road and tooted the horn outside his flat. Joe emerged and hurried towards the car, beaming. "Hello, you two," he slid into the front seat and leaned across to kiss my cheek. "Danny's excited we're all going out," I said. "Aren't you, Danny?" "Yeah," Danny said. "Thanks for asking me, kiddo. Any new tricks up your sleeve?" said Joe. "I'm working on one at the moment. Maybe you can show it to me later." Danny chuckled like a toddler in the back seat. "I'd love to," he said. "My son, the show off." We reached the theater, parked, and joined the throng walking to the Coliseum. Inside, the foyer bustled with parents accompanying children dressed in capes. Joe bought he and I a glass of wine and a bucket of popcorn for Danny, and we made our way into the hazy auditorium to find our seats. Danny perched between us, the popcorn bucket balanced on his knees, waving his wand like all the other little conjurers. Joe looked over my son's head at me and smiled, and I loved him for a moment, just for a moment. Then the lights went down. A low hum vibrated from the speakers. Children giggled. Time ticked. Then, with a burst of confetti and a flutter of flashes, Mike materialized mid-stage, white glove hand raising and greeting as Danny and the other children erupted into hysterics at the sight of their hero, swathed in silver cape and purple star-plush suit. "Good evening, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the greatest show on earth." Music struck up from the pit in a blast of pianos and brass, and Mike flowed across the stage, gloved hands up where we could see them, demanding our gaze. The communal enchantment being woven over the crowd drew me in. Mike swept about to the music, making crystal balls levitate, pulling a watch from behind the ear of a little girl in the front row, and tossing silver wands out to the audience. Joe lifted Danny, whose face was on fire with joy, to help him snatch a wand from the air. Another boy was lifted on stage, where Mike had him wave his new silver wand over a top hat, and then the white rabbit Mike had lowered into the hat popped out again, no longer white but brown. Ta-da! Mike the Conjurer flourished the hat and presented his empty black energy to the audience. I gaped at Joe as we joined the audience in rapturous applause. "Bag under the table," Joe mouthed. David had never been so cynical. The music shifted through various classical pieces. Mike's choreography won oohs and ahs from the crowd. I watched through rising tears. How many hours had our magic three spent watching Mike perform, snuggled together on the sofa? David, why aren't you here? Finally, the conjurer thrust his cape behind his shoulders and faced the audience center stage, mopping his brow with a star-spangled handkerchief. For my next trick, Mike scanned the auditorium, swirling his wand in circles, I need someone special. Danny leapt onto his seat, both hands in the air as other children followed suit, but Mike stalked the stage behind the footlights. Me, pick me, pick me! Joe and I leaned away from Danny as he screeched. Still, the wand swirled. Danny wrenched Joe's hand into the air and waved them both, mania in his face as, with a swoop and a flourish, Mike's wand jerked to a halt. Joe's eyes ran in surprise as the spotlight lit up he and my boy in its silver beam. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we have our next volunteers. Give them both a hand. Danny pulled Joe to his feet and dragged him towards the stage as the white noise of applause rose around us. Joe looked back at me, grimacing. Thrilled it was him and not me, I motioned him on with genuine enthusiasm. They were led on stage, Danny bouncing on his toes and waving the direction of where I sat, and looking breathtakingly, devastatingly, like David. A long black box on wheels with loose hanging straps was rolled out from behind a red curtain by three beaming women, each with a sheathed sword strapped to her back. Danny jumped up and down. Joe clutched his head with both hands. Mike went down on one knee beside Danny. What's your name, young magician? Daniel, and this is my mom's boyfriend, Joe. Wonderful to meet you, Daniel. Hi, mom's boyfriend, Joe. Daniel, do you think Joe would be up to helping us with a little trick? Danny shrieked eager assent, causing a cheer of agreement to rise up from the children around me as the woman rolled the box to a halt beside them. Several glances caught mine as the adults looked from each other to their excited offspring. We shook our heads in mutual bemusement. Kids, huh? With a dancer's grace, Mike opened both ends of the box so the audience could see down its length and invited Joe to do the same. Crouch down, sir, crouch down and tell us what you see. Is it an empty box, Joe? Mike asked. Joe hunkered down and peeked through the box, then straightened and raised a thumbs up to the audience. We applauded. The sparkle-coated woman strutted around him, reaching out to straighten his clothes and dust glitter from his hair while Mike took Danny off to the side to whisper in his ear. Joe hugged himself, shielding his eyes from the lights. When Mike and Danny turned back to the audience, the three women each took hold of Joe and led him to the rear of the box, while Danny stood, like his father, oh my god, hip cocked in one hand in one pocket. Mike gestured to Joe with his wand. Our volunteer approacheth the magic box, ladies and boys. All around me, children had leapt out of their seats to get a better view. In the midst of the chaos, I understood why the theater was named the Coliseum. Joe gripped the sides of the box, hefted himself inside, and lay flat. I watched the women shut the lid and secure the buckles tight before spinning the box around on the spot so we could see for ourselves that every belt was buckled and Joe was secure, his head and feet poking out either end. Mike perched Danny on the side of the box as the women took up positions along one side of it, the hilts of their swords glinting under the stage lights. Mike raised his hands. Silence fell. Is the box locked, Daniel? Mike asked. Danny tugged each belt. Yes. Can Joe get out, Daniel? No. Mum's boyfriend Joe is trapped, ladies and gentlemen. Any audience member looking at me might have thought there were tears of pride running down my face as I watched my son. Everyone thinks their children are beautiful, but Danny, his teeth perfect as baby pearls, his ecstasy, and I had never seen him this ecstatic, so plainly on display. Danny was captivating, and David was missing it. David would always miss it. I would never turn to him to share the joy of looking at the person we'd created who surprised us every day. We would never notice together how Danny's mannerisms echoed our own. Every direction I looked, children were sandwiched between two parents whose fingers were thoughtlessly entangled. Danny would always have an empty seat on one side of him at every big event, every birthday, at his graduation. It wasn't David who was with him on stage now. Could Joe ever truly share what I felt watching Danny grow, this child who every day reminded me of the greatest loss I'd yet faced? I married David for life and still had the heart I'd promised to love him with beating within me. Who was I supposed to give this love to if not him? A hush descending on the crowd pulled me back into the auditorium. Mike had called for quiet. There was a flourish of drum rolls. One of the women saw shade to Danny's side, eased her sword from its sheath, and presented its sparkling tip to the audience. The drum roll grew in volume and it grew in speed until, with a clash of cymbals, the woman thrust the sword through the side of the box, tearing a gasp from the audience. I winced at the sight of Joe's face scrunching. Mike froze in an attitude of horror, while the spare women clapped their hands to their mouths in pantomimes of shock. A popcorn-scented silence, whispers of waiting children teetering on their seats. Joe's eyes sprang open and he waggled his head back and forth. A screech went up from the children. The adults grinned. It took me a moment to realize the children weren't grinning. Their screeches had not been an appreciation of the jest. The children bayed at the stage like tiny wolves deprived of blood. Again, they shrieked. A tremor passed through me at the little milk fangs they bared as they lashed and pointed fingers at the stage, yelling. Mike waltzed around, riling them up. Is that again I hear you cry? Yes. Glove handcuffed to an ear. You want more? Yes. Why then, drum roll. Drums rolled. Beneath Danny's knees, Joe played dead. The second woman walked to the front of the box, unsheathed her sword, and showed the tip of it to Danny, who tapped it before nodding at the crowd and sucking his finger. Ooh, sharp. The crowd cheered, the drum roll intensified, then the second woman thrust the second sword to the box through Joe's thighs to a crash of cymbals and the thud of Mike dropping dramatically to his knees. The same expectant pause, then the same jeer from Joe as he came alive again, waggling his feet and sticking his tongue out at the children. I was touched by his getting into the spirit of the night so wholeheartedly, though the kid's bloodthirst had me spooked. The third woman strutted forward, sword unsheathed, straight as the horizon. She held it above her head, hilt against one palm and tip against the other, and presented the sword to my son. I sat up when Danny took it. The woman lifted him and stood him on the small table near Joe's head. Joe smiled at Danny. Hey, kiddo. Somewhere a drum rolled. Danny held the sword tip, pointing towards Joe's chest within the box. The ghosts and cheers of the children in the audience blistered into roars around me as I looked at Danny look at Mike. A pause, a tantalization. Then Mike made a sign. But Danny did not thrust the sword into the box on cue as I expected. Danny clenched the sword in both hands, raised his arms above his head, and plunged the weapon into Joe's exposed throat. Perhaps for some audience members, Joe's reaction was immediate. For me, it hung for a moment, a drop of blood easing from a pricked finger. I waited for the clash of cymbals, the trumpet, ta-da! I waited for Joe to laugh and stick his tongue out at Danny as he'd done before. Joe didn't. He started gurgling. I saw my little son lean his weight against the sword's hilt, and Joe's jaw stretch wide as he let loose a sound I'd never heard before. The women on stage huddled together as Mike's animated hands fell to his side, and they stared at Danny standing over Joe. Danny's lips were moving. A bubbling sound edged Joe's screams. Parents stared at each other, unsure whether to believe their eyes. I tried to think straight, but my thoughts veered off track in the direction I didn't send them. I wanted to run them to the stage, but when I tried to move, no muscles kicked into gear. I felt unbodied. Something was happening. My son was speaking words that sounded like, I'm telling you, Mama Bear, this kid's magical. An incantation. Daniel was conjuring. Joe's screaming intensified in pitch. Daniel pulled the sword with difficulty until he yanked it free, splattering his knees with red. As though released, terrified parents sprang into action, burying their children from the auditorium, screaming. Some children remained, those whose parents were frozen in shock. Had someone called the police? An ambulance? Someone had to call the police. Joe's screams frothed into silence. Danny hopped off the table and picked up his wand, blood spatter gleaming on his face. He spread his arms wide, cloak fanning out a shimmer of silver, and bowed to Mike and the women, who backed away from him as one. Feeling returned to my feet, and I slid into the aisle, wanting Danny and not wanting him. Someone had to call an ambulance. Joe. I fell to my knees as Danny jumped off the stage and strolled down the aisle towards me. Dan, I made no attempt to touch him. What have you done? My new trick, he said. A present for you, Mama. I looked behind him to where Mike stood, white face, staring at my child. The woman had disappeared. Joe's blood pooled around Mike's feet and seeped over the glass of the footlights, filling the auditorium in a glaze of gore. That's not the end yet, Dan said. For the next part, we need to go home. Daniel chattered in his seat behind me in the car as though nothing out of the ordinary had happened. It might have been paint on his face, and I picked him up from craft club. The car reeked of blood. Can we go faster? Danny asked. I want you to see the surprise. The weight of the darkness closed in as though the night were something we were driving into rather than through. A pregnancy out of the blue with no particular effort after almost 10 years of struggle. Some people had called Daniel's conception a miracle, some fate, others divine intervention. Had it been something else? I'm telling you, Mama Bear, this kid's magical. Had my magic-loving husband pulled a trick from up his sleeve? Us boys are taking a walk, Mama Bear. What did my son and my husband talk about between themselves that day? What surprise, Danny? I asked. What present did you mean? If I tell you, then it won't be a surprise. Tell me or I'll stop the car and we won't go anywhere until you answer me. Danny sighed. It had to be an exchange. The book said if you want something, you have to give something in exchange to keep it fair, like swaps. Exchange? Yeah, an exchange. What did you want to exchange, Danny? Are we nearly home? We were. All the downstairs lights were on when I turned the car into the road and approached our house. I hadn't left any lights on. Seeing the house aglow, Danny flung his seatbelt off and gripped the door handle, yelling, "It worked! It worked! It worked!" He was out of the car and racing towards the front door before I'd pulled off the handbrake. My son did not read occult literature. My son read books on magic tricks. He made coins vanish and always knew a card to pick. My son, like my husband, loved conjuring tricks, loved magic, one of the oldest forms of entertainment. Through the windscreen, I saw my front door open, spilling an oblong of orange light out onto the path. I tried to look but couldn't raise my eyes above my son, who stopped in his tracks as a shadow loomed in the sunset-shaded light from the hall. A smile broke Danny's red-stained face in two. He ran up the garden path with endless love shining in his eyes and leapt at the figure standing in the doorway. "Daddy, you're back." The end.
What the fuck?
I thought it was so weird, just like you guys did. Remember, he's like, "Mom, you should get a boyfriend." And I was like, "Oh, no."
What the fuck? What the hell? What the cradle jail? Wow.
Okay, well, I think that's it for our episode this week. Thank you to our guest for joining us and for reading a story.
Yeah.
Although I stuttered a lot.
It's okay. I'm proud of you. You did it. It
happens. We'll cut it now out. You know. No one will even know. Everyone will listen to this and be like, "What stutters?" Thank you. Yeah, you can come back anytime.
Oh my god, yes.
Yay! Well, we'll make you research next time. Okay. More hopeful.
Okay, you know what? Maybe I don't know.
Oh, suddenly I'm busy.
Yeah, I got a lot of homework to do.
Actually, me too. Can you just find a different co-host, Brayden, for a few weeks?
What?
Yeah, do you guys have anything you'd like to add?
No.
So no. Okay. Well, if anyone wants to email us, you can at thespookyshit.pod@gmail.com. Our Twitter and Instagram are spookyshit_pod, and our website is spookyshit-pod.com. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Okay, goodbye.